floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senors and senoritas. You know what time it is. It's walking the floor time. It's not just walking the floor time. It's Merry Christmas time. See what I just did there? I forget every time I'm posting one of these things and it's like a holiday week, I forget to acknowledge it, so I'm not doing that this time. This is Chris Shiflett wishing you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, a Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, Christmas Festus, whatever it is that you celebrate, however you celebrate it. I hope you have a great time and I didn't forget it this year. And also, I should let you know that I'm, this is actually going to be the last episode for a little while because I'm going to take a break through this festive holiday season and just kind of not do podcasting for a while because I'm sick of hearing my own voice. Which brings me to a question. Since we're closing out the year and it's a time of reflection, what do you like about walking the floor, and what do you dislike about walking the floor? What would you like to hear covered in this show? What kind of questions do you want to hear me ask the guests? Do you have any ideas for a segment? Anything. Shoot me a message. Hit me on the Twitter. You can DM me at my Instagram account. I look at that from time to time. I really don't ever look at Facebook, so don't bother sending me anything there, and I never look at the Walking the Floor website email thing, so just forget about that. Don't do that at all. But I would like to hear from you folks out there in the internet podcast land and just see, you know, what you're grooving on and what you ain't grooving on. And also, for those of you out there in the Southland, don't forget, I'm opening up for my brother's band, Face to Face, December 27th down in Gardena at the Locker Room, I think it's called. I'm playing solo acoustic, and they're doing an acoustic show. They're doing three nights, actually. I'm like at the middle night. So get tickets. Come on down to that. It's going to be super duper fun, and it'll be a hoot. You know, I haven't done a solo acoustic show, really like a full set type of solo acoustic show for a while, so I jumped up at the Brig over on Abbot Kinney over in Venice the other night and did like a full-on acoustic show. And it was really fun. It was kind of like, it wasn't exactly unannounced, but it wasn't like I wasn't hyping it like a regular show. It's my friend Crash does a night over there and there's like a pool tournament. It was super cool. Great scene over there. I kind of want to go do that again or even do that regularly. It was hip. It just brought into focus for me how domesticated and middle-aged I am and how much I do not hang out at bars anymore. Because it was swinging, man. Swinging. I was still in bed by midnight. So, just want you to know. Still responsible. Okay, let's pay some bills. Did you know Zounds has been around since 1996? That's right. Zounds.com, the greatest internet retailer of music instrument-related goods on the planet. If you didn't know they've been around since 1996, it all started way back when as a small retail shop and has since grown to become one of the biggest and best badass online musical instrument retailers on earth. So get on over to Zounds.com today because their entire staff is musicians, man. What are you waiting for? Merry Christmas. You got some Christmas presents to get. You could squeeze in there. All right, let's get to today's interview.
Where there's smoke, you'll find fire. Where there's fire, you'll find a crowd.
Now, of course, I know everybody listening knows who Jack Ingram is. This is, in fact, the second time I've interviewed Jack for this here podcast. Texas native, proud Texan, Jack Ingram, a maker of fantastic records, a road warrior, a man committed to taking it out there to the people, rocking and rolling night after night. We did this interview in my hotel room in Nashville during Americana Fest at the end of the summer, September, whenever that was. I just want to warn you, during the interview, we had a cell phone a little too close to the little digital interface thing that I use to do my interviews. And so about midway through the interview, you get some of that iPhone crackle weird thing where, like, you know that sound when your phone's too close to something and it's downloading information and it starts glitching out? It does that a bunch. It doesn't do that enough to ruin the interview. You can still listen to it. It's still great. Jack's awesome. It's always fun talking to him, but just so you know. And if you haven't listened to his latest record, Riding High, again, The title of which is a nod to the classic Jerry Jeff Walker record, Riding High. It's really, really good. You should go listen to it now. It's cool. It's loose. It's vibey. It's everything you want it to be. And so is Jack Ingram on Walking the Floor.
There's a guy in a bar who just can't get over her.
So what's up? What brings you to Americana Fest this week? Like, are you doing gigs every night, doing the whole boogie woogie?
I'm not doing the whole. Like, it's interesting to come to town for this week where you can do as much as you want. Like, there's all kinds of shit going on every day and different gigs, but it's nice just to, at some point, a few years ago, it's like, I love coming here and being a part of it, but I don't feel the need to run on a treadmill anymore.
Right. Right. Well, it sort of begs the question, like, this, you know, Americana Fest or South by South, a similar thing, like, what is sort of the purpose of these things for people who are established artists? You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, for me, it's I'm an established artist in a couple different areas, you know? So it's right. Like, for me, this is the world that I got into music for.
Right.
You know, it wasn't called Americana back then. It was just called Kris Kristofferson or whatever.
Yeah.
Or Lucinda or Steve. And so I think, for me, it's just to come be a part of it and not feel the need to make any new, you know, inroads into anything, but just kind of come and plant my flag for a couple nights. I played last night at a show. I'm doing the thing with Paul because he's a buddy.
Yeah.
I drink with him at the bar in Austin. And then to be a part of the awards show.
Right.
That came in kind of last minute. They asked me. But I guess that's what I'm saying. It's nice to be here. Like, they called me. They didn't call me first. They called me like 3 days ago and said, "Hey, are you a Delbert McClinton fan?" And I started laughing. I was like, do you know who you called, right?
Right.
And then they asked me to present his Lifetime Achievement Award.
Mm.
And so stuff like that, it's nice to be here, not be banging on doors, but to have something fall in your lap that's meaningful to me and maybe will be meaningful to them too. Like, it makes sense for me to give an achievement award to Delbert.
Did you live in Nashville for a stretch?
No.
Oh, you never lived here?
I never moved here.
Okay, because I kind of thought of like your last record in my mind was like your leaving Nashville record, and this new one's almost like your back home in Texas record or something. But
right.
Am I getting that storyline a little off?
Well, you're getting the themes right.
Right.
I just wasn't physically here.
Right, okay.
But yeah, starting with Midnight Motel, when you and I first met and talked, that was like the first record of, you know, for 15 years, man. I mean, since I started playing in 1990, I thought Guy Clark and Jerry Jeff and those guys didn't have consistent hits on the radio back in the 70s or when they... I thought it was because they weren't trying hard enough. Like, I thought...
And then you learn there's this thing called the biz.
Yeah, seriously. And then I just figured once I get hits on the radio, I'll do the bait and switch.
Right.
And I realized that that's not how that works, man. Like, those guys on Music Row are doing just fine. They like what they're doing.
Right.
They're not bitching about Florida Georgia Line or anybody else. Like,
right.
They love what they're doing. And so you come in from Texas and you're like, I'm here to help you guys. I'm going to get hits on the radio and we're going to turn this thing into what it should have been the whole time. And they're like, fuck you.
Right.
You want to get into our party and start talking about how our chicks are ugly?
Right.
And it's like, once I realized that was going to be an uphill battle, not worth fighting for an entire career. And people like what they like, man. They're like, people love 4.7 billion people eat at McDonald's.
Right.
And the hamburger joints I like are not that.
But it's interesting. It's interesting to hear you say that, because I would think that you, by the time you started coming to Nashville or like, you know, being around that sort of more mainstream country music world, like, you were already an established dude at that point. Like, when maybe after your first few records, or were you like doing co-writes with guys here? Were you sort of part of that whole
thing? So I was always, I came on my own two feet. Like, I didn't come and knock on doors just to have a career.
Right.
because I just didn't, I, that didn't, that never crossed my mind.
Right. Because you had already built one, really.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And right, I just knew, like, I was starting from scratch when I started playing music, so I never wanted to ask any, I didn't want to knock on doors and ask for opportunities, because I was pretty sure they'd say, we're not really interested at any level, whether it was mainstream or any other place. So I just started writing songs and playing music, and then had an audience when I came up here, had a fan base to talk about. Because I got my first booking agent that way. I knocked on his door, this guy named Davis McClarty, who books really good acts down in Austin. He books Bruce and Kelly and friends. Like, he's booked a lot of people for a long time. He used to play drums with Joe Ely. But I learned that lesson right away. I knocked on his door, knew he booked Joe Ely, and I said, hey, will you book me? He said, send me whatever. I sent him a cassette at the time. He didn't really dig it. He didn't say that.
Right.
But he called me back and said, hey, man, I'm not sure, but so what are you doing? Like, we started talking. I said, what are you doing? And as soon as I go, well, man, I played 65 shows last year and grossed about $65,000-$70,000. He goes, man, maybe we can work something out. Right. And that's not a slight on him, man.
Right.
That's
just, yeah, yeah.
But I realized very, very quickly that way of, like, if I bring something to the table, like, I'm doing this already, people in the business will go, oh, if you're doing that already on your own, we can probably double that, and
right,
then that's real money. And I had a sense of that early on. So in other words, I came up to town and started knocking on doors, and I wasn't just asking for a handout.
Right.
And through that process, I always just kind of thought, I'll figure out what a co-write is, and I did. And the first one was fucking miserable, because I was young, and I thought I was maybe doing him a favor. Right. This guy had just written three number ones for
sure.
Some dude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And after about 30 minutes or an hour of us kind of throwing around some idea, he goes, hey, let's go get some lunch. And we went and had beers at Brown's and a burger, and we had a good afternoon. I go, well, that's not bad. It was an awful co-write, but we went and had a, got to know each other and had a good time. And the next one went a little better. And,
right.
And I had really good people around me that knew what kind of stuff I was really into. And so they were hooking me up with guys who were also into that stuff. And
I think it's tough until you get to know somebody. Like, I haven't done a ton of co-writing, but that is, like, songwriting is like, it's like one of the most exposed moments of your whole life.
It
you
is.
Know what I mean? This is what I think is great. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Because that's basically what you're saying. And,
right.
And when you're sitting down trying to write a song. So it's,
and you're, well,
I,
for
it's
me,
I think it's a skill you got to kind of hone at and learn at, you know?
You do. But luckily, like, I had a degree in psychology from, that's what I studied in college, and I've just always been into that. And you're also asking for help, though.
Right.
You know,
which is also tough, especially in a kind of a macho music culture,
right,
you know?
Well, luckily for me, that wasn't hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of knew I was in this phase of, like, I wanted to learn. Everybody says it's a mystery and it's a muse and stuff, but I was like, well, it's a mystery and a muse, but all these people are doing it every day.
Right.
And every time I'm going to a co-write, if I just, I think one of my talents maybe is that I'm not really that hung up on being vulnerable when it comes to songwriting. Now, when it comes to walking around the streets and walking onto a stage and acting like I built this world and I'll tear it down if I want to kind of vibe, that's a different deal. But when it comes to, like, the heart of the matter, I've always just been able to go, here I am.
Right.
Let's do this. And I'm lucky that way. Because you're right. That is a difficult thing for a lot of people. And
yeah.
I think that's the only reason why I got good at it, or why I learned how to co-write pretty quickly. Because
right.
I would just be like, man, I'm wide open here. I'm naked.
With your latest record, with Riding High Again, did you, am I right in, I think I read that, like, you wrote the originals on it, like, live in the studio kind of thing, just in the moment?
One song for sure, Where There's a Willie, There's a Waylon. That was written, I kind of had the idea of what it was. And we got to the studio and I was just, what are we going to do next? Well, let's take 30 minutes and we'll go write this song.
Right.
Because I kind of knew what it was. And John Randall and I have been writing songs together for years.
He's the guy that produced it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's the guy that we wrote Ten Man with. And I wrote some songs on the first, you know, we've just been writing a long time together.
Yeah.
And plus that was one of those things where I knew that the whole, that's, I don't write very many songs that are just centered around a hook. One, but I just knew that this, where this lands.
Like you started with the hook and worked your way backwards kind of
thing. Yeah, because I saw a sticker on my piano that said, what is it? Where there's a Willie, there's a way.
Right.
I had a, some like South by Southwest, I picked up some stickers, some promotional company or something.
Some Willie Nelson propaganda.
Yeah, where there's a Willie, there's a way. And I started laughing and said, that almost makes sense. Like, it's funny. Yeah. It's a good little play on words. But then I was like, but where there's a Willie, there's a Waylon.
It's like one of those lines that you're like, how the fuck did nobody pick that out of the ether until right now?
Ones that I love, because those don't happen very often. Yeah. So once I knew that, like, where there's a Willie, there's a Waylon, I was like, that song writes itself.
Yeah.
Especially if I'm, and writing a Willie and a Waylon song goes perfectly with writing with a buddy.
Right.
Who, and I think is Towns Van Zandt or guy, you know, I think he's one of the best, John Randall's one of the best guys, writers that I've ever been around.
Right.
So, but the whole idea of that record, Riding High Again, was to do that. It was to just go in and, well, you live in a world where that happens a lot, where people don't have songs before they go in the studio, or it used to be that way in rock and roll, you know, right. Like,
where, well, it's interesting, like in Foo Fighter land, it's like sort of the process, it's very different process than like what I've seen around Americana and country, where like we go in and start working on demos, you know, Dave has some riffs and we go and start working on demos, and at a certain point that just becomes the record. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like what you're saying. I mean, it's like the songs aren't anywhere near done.
That's kind of what
and,
I mean.
And it's like there's some gray space there where, oh, wait, now we're actually making the record.
Right.
You know?
That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because it does feel a little more... I was interested in the moment of creation.
Right.
That, to me, is the best of rock and roll.
And it's got like a loosey-goosey live feel. Like, is that mostly live?
Yeah, we set up the studio where I could just play. You know, there's a mattress in front of me. I mean, I was looking, one of the two records, both records, I was looking at the drummer. His kick drum was going right into the mattress in front of me where I was singing above. Mm. And that to me, like, well, that moment of creation is, I've had this argument with a bunch of, not argument, but a discussion over the last 30 years with people that are like, they don't dig country music or whatever, but they love what I do, or that kind of, I'm sure you get that every now and again too, but like, and I understood what they were saying, because rock and roll feels like it might fall apart.
Right.
When it's done right.
Yeah.
And to me, rock and roll isn't a style of music. It's just, it's like Jerry Jeff Walker is as big a rock and roller as Mick Jagger, and George Jones is as big a rock, you know, like,
yeah,
people who are willing to lay it out and fall head first out of the window onto the street.
Well, there's that great thing of like assembling a bunch of really great players.
Yeah.
And then keeping that loose. You know what I mean? Sort of the discipline and strength that all those guys are going to bring to it. It's not going to be shitty.
Right.
It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to fall apart, but it's going to get close here and there, you know what
right.
I mean?
Well, that's the whole idea, is to get these players to, like, that's one of the things that was really stifling about being in the for the couple records I made in the mainstream world on Music Row, is that they're not willing to fail. Like, there's nothing that's ever gonna fail or fall apart completely and fail. Like, they're not willing to do that. So you bring a demo, you say you like it, or you do the demo and you like it. You get in the studio. Remember the first session I had with Big Machine? I got in the studio and I said, okay, here's the song we're doing. And I got my guitar out. They go, what are you doing? I go, well, I'm gonna run down the song. I go, no, we got the demo. And I was new to that party, that particular group of friends.
Yeah.
And when they go, no, we got the demo, I was like, okay, that's cool. They played the demo, and they're like, okay, write charts, do the thing, get out on the floor, and I was kind of like, well, and I was a pro at this point.
Right.
I'd already made records, but not like this.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand what that was, and so we start playing, and man, like, the head lick from the demo is what the dude's playing on the floor, and I go, And by that time, the train's left the station, man.
Yeah.
And this is my first single with a big label. And I go, oh, all right, this, all right, this is cool. But over the course of time, like, that's kind of the main reason why I go, fuck this, man.
Right.
Like, I want to make records that have a chance to be fucking brilliant.
Well, are there ever moments in those kind of recording sessions where, you know, the guitar player or whoever is given a little freedom to, like, well, maybe that's, like, to change it, you know, to come up with something different and better,
just,
you know what
I mean? Just the framework that you had to put that in, like, right, where the guitar player's given a little
freedom. Right, right.
Like, I don't want to, I'm not giving you, play the worst lick in the world. It might be the best you've ever, like, that's what I mean. It's all so controlled.
It's all
going to be good.
Right.
It's going to be really, really good and solid. And these players, man, they're better than Tiger Woods at golf.
Oh, yeah.
At their instruments.
Yeah.
They can do anything you want. They just don't ever get to do what they want.
Sure.
And so it's really, I just knew when I left that world, and I say left that world, I mean, I still live in that world. You know, I saw friends there, and I love a lot of people there, and they make really good records, and they love their records.
Yeah.
I wasn't digging what I was doing.
Yeah.
And that's when I go, man, I need to go jump off cliffs.
Yeah.
That's more fun to me.
I read a good quote of yours where you were talking about, I think the context was maybe the difference between listening to a record on speakers and listening to records on headphones. Like, when you got the headphones on, there's, like, you're hearing little shit in there that you're missing otherwise, you know?
Absolutely.
And I, to me, that ties into, you know, how there's, like, between song banter and little stories and shit on your last couple records that are, you know, you never hear that nowadays.
Ever.
Even in, like, Americana or whatever.
Right.
Like, that's like next level loosey-goosey, you know what I mean? Like, I know, like, the title of the record was, like, a nod to that J. Jeff Walker record, but was that also, you know,
that whole
keeping
thing,
that spirit?
Man, that whole thing is, I just remember as a kid having headphones on, or even just, you know, when we used to lay down, just lay on the floor and put my speakers aimed at my ears.
Yeah.
And just going, what are they, like that Tom Waits song, what is he building in there? I just remember listening to music going, what are they doing?
Right.
You could hear somebody say something, drop something, or Jerry Jeff make a crack, or some, like, I'd have to be crazy.
Drums to hit the floor.
Whatever, man. Yeah. Or like, when Willie Nelson did I'd Have to Be Crazy, on a record called Greatest Hits and Some That Will Be. Like, I love the ego and the, like, the confidence of Willie going, yeah, you love these, trust me, you'll love these too.
Right.
I'm gonna put these on, you know. And one of the songs that wasn't a hit was I'd Have to Be Crazy, the song by Stephen Fromholtz. And during the bridge, and I don't intend to, but should there come a day if I say I don't love you, you can lock me away. There's just some baritone voice in the studio. You can hear him feeding Willie Nelson the lines.
No, wait, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it became like, if I don't intend, should there come a day? And I remember going, this is a greatest hits record. Like, it just wowed me, like, that they're so loose. And
And
I began to understand, like, that's what I'm into.
And
those old Stones records, like, all those old records, man. Like, there were things happening that made me go, what are they doing in there? How do I get in that room?
With a lot of those old Stones recordings, like, the arrangements are so crazy that I always, and I don't know this to be true, but just as a musician, this is my theory, that they were just jamming those tunes and winging it, and that was, like, the take that felt good, and then Mick Jagger had to go back and put some lyrics on it. But, like, you know, a song like Bitch, there's, like, a whole section in the verse where there's just no words.
Right.
You know, like, maybe he just didn't have an idea, and then all it just kind of, there's nothing there.
Right.
Nobody does anything, and then boom, it's back to the core. You know what I mean? It's just like, because that's how they did it that one time or whatever.
And that's what I fell in love with. And I think country music, I mean, I also love tight country music, don't get me wrong. But when it's loose and feels like we're talking about, that's just, that's what got me thinking, because I've just not very, I've never been a real technical person about anything.
Right.
And so, I guess, kind of probably subconsciously, man, I'm always looking for situations that you have to build the parachute on the way down.
Right.
Because,
well, and there's also that thing of, like, making decisions in the studio based on your ears instead of your eyes. Instead of, like, wait, no, that's not,
yeah,
where it's supposed to be and based on the grid, you know what I mean?
Like, I remember when those grids started coming up, when Pro Tools first started coming, I was making a record with Steve Earle and Ray Kennedy. Mm. They were called the Twang Trust. And I remember being completely like aghast at, like, we were doing what we were doing over there, but there was a studio across the hallway that was doing like, I don't know, like one of those vocal group kind of records, like a right. real mainstream thing.
Yeah.
And I remember going over there, and that engineer was, just, every time I'd walk in, he was just, and he was taking out breaths.
Mm.
He was like, he was taking out all of the air in the track.
Yeah.
In between the phrasing of the vocals, in between the guitar, like if the guitar wasn't doing something, that mic got turned off. And he's just sitting there putting this million piece crossword puzzle together.
Yeah.
And I just remember that just did not go with, it made me laugh. And then I thought, I don't ever want to do that. I don't ever want to be part of that.
Yeah.
And then when I finally fought my way into the mainstream world where I had a chance to have hits and do what I want to do, that school of thought was so pervasive that I was like, it was like fighting a brick wall to say, hey man, what about this? It was like, yeah, go back to Texas and be cool if you want to do that.
Right.
We do this way. Yeah. And I was old enough by that point to understand, yes, you do, and y'all do that really well, and it's not a fight I'm going to fight anymore.
Yeah.
You want me, like, I'm not going to go stay, like, I'm not just going to go home and hole up in Texas, but yeah, I'm going to go do things my way. I'm going to bet for the first time in my life that I have enough, whatever it takes, talent or otherwise, to do it what I consider the right way, which is my way, you know? Right. So it's a trip that way. Yeah.
So is your latest record the same, more or less the same cast of characters as the last one? Is it Charlie Sexton playing guitar?
Sexton's on the guitar.
Can you explain, and I realize you're not Charlie how Sexton's representative. Yeah, but I just want, I try to wrap my head around Charlie Sexton. Like, I don't know Charlie Sexton, but I just see him pop up here and there, and he's always like playing the coolest guitar with the perfect part and the right tone and looks amazing. And yeah. But like, what?
You got him.
explain like.
You just explained it.
But like, how come he doesn't make more records of his own? He's like, you know, for a guy who's like, because that's such a supreme talent. Yeah. Like, how come he only really has a few records over the years?
No, I can't get into the psyche of that. For real, why? I know why. I think because I think probably a lot of us have been through that. I know my experience. He got burned, man.
Right.
He was going to be the next big thing two or three times.
Right.
Like, huge thing.
Right.
And in a stylized era where there was the mullets and the things, and he was fucking gorgeous.
Right.
Like, he's got better cheekbones than Liv Tyler.
Right.
And so it's like, when that, for whatever reason, didn't, I would guess that for some of the things that I've kind of, what we talked about like how I just go, if there's no room for me to do it the way I hear it, then I think probably in his world, man, he was in an era where computers, like tight pop rock was coming into vogue.
Yeah.
And I think he got burned. And became more about how pretty he was and stuff like that. Mm. And I think probably for him, like, he's one of, you know this, he's one of the best guitar players in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And so musical, and has like a, he's like a walking encyclopedia or Google of cool random shit that he picks from. So that's what I think at some level. It's like, in order for him to make a record, I know he's doing some recording, and he'll make records. And also, as you know, some people really just get in that role where they get to be a part of great projects.
Right.
And they don't have to do any of the other bullshit.
Well, it's funny, you know, because that was one of the things I was going to ask you about. Like, you know, I just put a record out this year, and I think for the first time in my life came to the conclusion that, like, I love making records, and I love going out and playing shows, and I love all the stuff that goes into making a record, but everything else about putting out a record, I fucking hate. Right. It's a gigantic pain in the ass, right. You know what I mean? Like, where do you find the fucking strength or whatever to go through it? Because, you know, for people who don't do it, they don't necessarily get, like, how much, you're just spending all day, every day, corralling everybody, and nothing against anybody on my team.
Right.
They're all
right,
wonderful. Right. But you are spending, that becomes your entire focus to, when you're putting out. For months and months and months, you're just talking to your manager and your booking agent and your publicist and the people at the label and the this and that, and trying to get all those people to coordinate everything together. And then if everything right. goes perfectly, maybe you'll get added to the right playlist. Or, right. You know what I mean? Like all that shit. You know what I mean? Like,
if somebody deems you worthy
right,
of their playlist.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's crazy. Like
I quit doing it.
I might just be burnt out because I've been touring too much this year. But like I came to the realization a little recently, like I'm never putting out an album again. I'm going to put out a song.
Right.
I'm going to put out one song.
I think that's a good idea. I think that's, for that idea, I think is a good idea. I would love to put out a song a month for.
Right.
28 months or yeah. whatever. But as far as the other stuff, I stopped doing it.
Right.
That is the thing. I came to that realization too, and it's like so much of that shit is out of your control. You're asking to make sure other people care about your project as much as you do, and then judging how much they care and how much they're going to do for you, and it's out of my control. I said, don't get me wrong. I understand that it's there, and I kind of just weighed, I don't know, man. I just, if I stop caring about shit I can't control, I know that I might not get as many people, many ears on my record, as many articles and newspapers and magazines and shit, but if I make the right record one day, that'll all pop in the way that I've seen it work for other people, where the music just leads, goes in front of you. I spent my whole first half, whatever the years before this were, I was out in front of my music because I was scared it wouldn't work and that I wouldn't have a career and that people wouldn't dig it. And so I'd get out and I'd do all that stuff in front of it. Yeah, man, we're doing this and this and that, blah, blah, and that. And then I was like, fuck this, man. Music has to lead. Go work for me. Go find people who like you and come back and I will be nice to them. And I'll never lie. Like I'll be the perfect guy. I will do what I do in the way that I do it if they like it. If they don't like it, man, I can't control that and I'm done trying.
It's funny, we came up with this theory in the van that, of course, nothing against Dwight Yoakam. I love Dwight Yoakam, but Dwight has a reputation of being a kind of a hard ass,
yeah.
and hard on people,
right?
That are promoters or whoever.
And friends.
Yeah, right. And freaking the fuck out about shit being done wrong or whatever, you know what I mean?
I had a great story about that, by the way.
Well, we were laughing about it. Like, if you hang around this industry long enough, you become Dwight Yoakam. And, like, that's the trick. I don't want to be one of those people that fucking screaming and yelling all the time. And I feel like I've spent a little maybe too much time this year doing some screaming and yelling.
That's why I stopped worrying about it, man. Because you're right. If you continue to try to manipulate things you can't control, it'll drive you crazy.
Yeah.
And you're right, man. Like, I do remember when I used to hear, I remember when I was first starting out, I was in the management office, and Lyle Lovett, he's only doing this many interviews, and he won't do any college interviews, and I was like, what? That's crazy. And then 15 years later, I found myself going, I'll only do these interviews, saying the same things to people that I was like, that's crazy. Why won't you talk to everybody about your music? And it's like, you just kind of start, grow up and you go, man, these things are important, these things are not. It'll all come out in the wash. And just to take that a step further, it's like, man, if you don't want to become Dwight Yoakam, which I, first of all, hold on, just like you, I love Dwight. I fucking love him. Right. I think he's hilarious. Yeah. When I hear stories about him getting pissed off about stuff, I think it's when I saw him one time get pissed off. He was screaming about something happened in the back alley of the Ryman. I think it was like 2 years ago at this award show. We were both there at the same time to present an award. And he's like, comes in just hot, pissed off, banging on the door, and motherfucking, hey, goddamn it, motherfucker. He got stuck in the alley because he didn't have his credentials.
Ah, shit.
And so he was all pissed off that he had to fight through. And Imagine he's coming up. He got dropped off on Broadway.
Yeah.
And like right by Tootsie's.
Oh, God.
Everybody there fucking knows who he is. And he looks like Dwight Yoakam. Yeah. So they're all, he's got a whole pass of people coming. Dwight Yoakam. Yeah. So he's like trying to get through the cop. The cop goes, nope, can't get through.
Oh, shit.
He's like, what the fuck? So he's freaking out. Comes in, he's banging on the door. The stage door is open. So the show's going on. You hear, fuck a motherfucker. And he goes, oh, hey, Jack. Bow, bow, bow. And I was like, I love this guy. Like, you tell him, hey, Jack, how you doing, buddy?
What the fuck are you doing?
Anyway, so...
That's so great.
But that's another thing, man. That's another thing that I really am interested in, is that I think he is so singularly driven. And he, like, it's hard for me as a people pleaser... It was work for me to become that selfish about my music and go, no, I do not want any more opinions. I don't want anybody to tell me what they think I should do. I'm willing to fail miserably. And I think he's the same. I think there are some artists, like, I think he's that way. I think his chaos is in his head, and it may kind of swirl around him at times, but he's a sweet, sweet man.
Right.
But when it comes to, like, his chaos is his chaos, and he owns it, man.
Yeah. That's...
He doesn't
Some
know.
People, that's just their comfort zone.
He doesn't know he's Dwight Yoakam or that, like, the one we're talking about. Right. He knows the one inside his head. That's the only one he knows.
Right. Yeah, that's too fucking funny, man. So, like, at this point, like, how do you sort of know when it's time for you to make a new record? Like, are you always just kind of compiling songs and get having ideas bouncing around, and then at a certain point it just fills up? Like, how do you make that decision? Like, I got to make a record now.
Well, it used to be based around kind of career stuff and timing, but after doing the record this way, I also feel like some things are changing for me. Like, I have a lot of songs that I write. I mean, I'm writing all the time, half songs and three.
Yeah.
I don't finish many of them.
Sure.
Yeah. But like right now, I feel like, okay, if I book some studio time, not force myself because I want to. There's that thing where it's like finishing those songs in the studio and actually digging them now. That was killer. Because there's an immediacy to finishing a song when you're going to record it. You know that thing when you write a song and then you play it for somebody. You know where it's fucked. Where you need to. That line didn't work. I lost.
Right.
I lost the crowd a little bit.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about recording it. That day or that week, that immediacy is right there, and it's really nice. It's comforting because it gives me a stopping point. Like with my songs, I think I don't finish some of them or a lot of them because they're never finished.
Right.
Unless there's a reason to finish them.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. Like, you know? Unless you have that deadline looming out there on the horizon somewhere when you know that beginning date of your records come or whatever it is, you know, like...
I think my goal this time is to somehow continue that immediacy of the art and of the song. But like, I look at this record and laugh. Like, every song's like 8 minutes long.
Right.
I'm like, I'm kind of asking a lot of these people. So that's going to be fun for me, is to figure out how to get these songs, have that looseness, but then go, okay, let's take care of business in 2:30.
Right.
Or 3, or whatever is like a tight arrangement.
You know what's funny is I didn't realize it when I was making my last couple records, but like every one of my songs is like 2 minutes long. Like I didn't think about that. I just, you know, it just felt good or whatever. And now when I'm going out and tour, like we were playing a festival the other day, we had an hour. I put like a million songs out. I said, boys, we're going to have to fucking cook through this thing. And we got through the whole fucking thing. We still had 10 minutes left. I was like, what the fuck? Whoops. We extend some jams.
But man, listening to your records though, I would imagine that the kind of like one of the things that you loved about country music when you got into it, or Americana, whatever, is those old Johnny Cash songs and the stuff that especially was more obvious on your first record.
Yeah,
like those were.
Oh yeah, some of those Merle songs had like one verse and a chorus.
They were tight.
Yeah, you know what I mean. It was
just, and so that's kind of how you got into writing in that vein.
Definitely.
So it's just I think that's just a trip, because you're right. And my whole thing was like, okay, how do I turn this into, like, when you're cutting those songs that are 6, 7, 8 minutes long, I was so inside of that zone that felt like a minute.
Right.
Like, it wasn't until a year after the record came out that I go, wow, these songs are long.
Right.
And I've worked hard. I had to work hard to become that oblivious.
Right. Well, that's good. It speaks to, like, just being in the moment with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I used to really... It was much more of a driven thing of, like, there was a purpose, and I'm really enjoying... I had to learn how, but now that I got to this place where I can really lose myself, it's like... It's a little scary. I mean, it's not scary, but it's like, I can't... I don't want to go back.
Right.
Now I just want to have a little few tight arrangements.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about. And then if you want to play a song, great. And if you don't, that's fine too. There was a thing on your website that, and I've thought about this before, about, I wonder if it would be possible to route a tour this way. And you have a play in my town request, like, button thing on your website. Does that work? Like, do you actually?
Nothing works on the website.
Well, I mean, in the sense, like, do you actually, like, do people, like, request, like, hey, come to fucking bumfuck wherever?
People do.
And then you, like, what is that?
People, that's a hope.
Like, do you read those? I guess is what I'm asking.
I read them, no. But I get them on social media all the time, complain my time. I wish.
Well, I think every time you post, anytime anybody posts something like, hey, I got this run of dates, that all the responses are, come to Duluth. You never come to Poughkeepsie. You know, blah, blah, blah.
You were there 2 weeks ago.
Right, exactly.
That whole, that's funny, man. Like, trying to figure out where your people are.
Right.
You know, that's the final frontier, is like really figuring out where they are. Because... I think that's the next level of what I'm trying to do. Of like, what I did find out is that when you have hits on the radio, and I always knew, man, my heroes were my heroes the whole time, Guy Clark and Willie and Jerry Jeff and those people. They don't necessarily jump with you back, and so, like, mainstream fans love that stuff, and I love the part of mainstream that I was in. I love that some of it, but like. When I knew where I was going to, it was kind of like starting over a little bit.
Right.
Because the people that loved me when I was completely independent for 10 years, before I had anything on the radio, well, when you jump to the radio, they go, he was cool, but he's doing that other thing now. He's the dancing monkey, you know. And then the people that fall in love with you over here, when you go back to... or veered back in the direction of where you came from, it's not that they can't call you a sellout. They have a different argument. They just aren't aware. They listen to the radio.
Right.
They watch Jimmy Fallon only.
Right, like, right, right.
If you're not in their world, it's out of sight, out of mind.
Sure.
And so there's this interesting thing of, that thing was put on there because I do want to, like, you want to know where you can go. That's not based, like, when you have radio airplay or record sales like we used to have, you know where they're buying your records, you know where they're playing your song. That's how you base a tour. Or that's how I used to do it. It's like, they're playing me there, let's go there.
Right,
we sold 455 records there last week, let's go there.
Yeah.
But all that's gone up in smoke.
Sure.
It's, you know, and so it's like, okay, well, it's not uncommon for me to sell 700 tickets one night and go to a town 3 hours away and sell 75.
Right.
And you go, huh, how do we fix this? And I'm finding out that you just don't, man. Like, that's just the way this is.
Yeah.
Like, you go play your shows and you hope for the best, and you hope next time there's more and that people dig it. And other than that, so that button was kind of like, I also have a button there for happy marriage. that I keep pushing. and friendships that last.
Yeah. You know? Good luck.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Right, right. That's about as easy to find as where people want you to play.
Cool, man. Well, fucking thanks. Thanks for coming by during what is, of course, a very busy week, I'm sure.
I'm sure it's busy for you. And good luck in the next hour.
Thank you.
Put your seatbelt on. There's a green hall where we
can dance. Oh, yeah, that was Jack Ingram on Walking the Floor. Make sure to get on over to walkingthefloor.com. Going to post some links, some of the things that we discussed, and some things we didn't discuss. I love Jack Ingram. What a good dude. You know, I was just noticing how stuffy my nose sounds. I don't want you to worry out there. I'm not sick. I just have half of the Ventura Harbor up my nose because I surfed up there this morning. And while I was recording this little ramble thing, a bunch of salt water just leaked out of my nose. You probably didn't need to know that. It's a little disgusting. But that's what accounts for my stuffy stuffy old sound this morning. And just for another reminder, I'm going to be gone for, I don't even know till when. I'm just going to take some time off from doing the podcast because it's the holidays and that's what you do. And I'm going to be off enjoying myself. And I hope you're off enjoying yourself somewhere too. So until we meet again, adios amigos!